Hi, and welcome to Bio and Ethical, the podcast where we question existing norms in medicine, science, and public health. I'm Leah Pearson, an MD-PhD candidate at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health.
And I'm Sophie Jabert, a PhD candidate in philosophy at MIT.
Today, we're talking about ethics education. Is it possible to make doctors, researchers, and public health professionals behave more ethically just by teaching them about ethics? Is that the primary thing we should be trying to do when we're teaching ethics anyways? And if so, how can we do it? And how might we know if we're succeeding?
This may seem like a niche topic, but bear with us. If ethics education really worked, and if we could use it to prevent unethical practices, that would be pretty incredible. It would vindicate the time, energy, and money that is currently put into the system of ethics education, and it may suggest that we should devote even more resources to it.
There is certainly plenty of unethical behavior that it would be great to prevent, even just within medicine. On the one hand, there's flagrantly unethical behavior. For example, there's the case of Dr. Christopher Dunch, a physician who on many occasions partied, binge drank, and used cocaine until the wee hours of the morning before driving to his hospital to perform delicate spinal surgeries. Dr. Dunch's license was eventually revoked by the Texas Medical Board. However, by the time they revoked it, he had paralyzed two patients and killed another two. In another recent case, a plastic surgeon who went by Dr. Roxy on TikTok was warned by the Ohio Medical Board about the risks to patient confidentiality of live streaming her surgeries. She then took remediation courses in ethics and professionalism, but subsequently continued live streaming surgeries to hundreds of thousands of people on TikTok, even looking at and speaking to the camera while making incisions. After many of her patients suffered serious complications, her medical license was revoked.
On the other hand, there are subtler ethical lapses, which are exceedingly common and still have severe consequences. For instance, because patients have unique interests and goals, whenever possible, they should be allowed to make their own informed decisions about whether to receive treatment. But in practice, physicians often fail to recognize that incapacitated patients lack capacity, meaning that hospitalized patients may often be asked to make medical decisions they are not cognitively equipped to make.
Ethics has been a recognized component of medical practice since Hippocrates' time. However, formal ethics education within professional schools, including medical schools, is a much more recent innovation. Bioethics education arose alongside the development of the field of bioethics itself. In the early 1960s, physicians were grappling with new questions that they did not feel equipped to answer. Advances in medical technology have made it possible to keep patients alive long after they had any hope of regaining consciousness, raising difficult questions about whether and when it was justified to withdraw life-sustaining treatment. Medical technology was becoming increasingly expensive, raising questions about how to distribute scarce medical resources. And as physicians began to specialize more and rely on tests and procedures that could only be performed in hospitals, the nature of the physician-patient relationship became more impersonal, making medical paternalism harder to justify.
Physicians began looking to philosophers to help teach courses in medical ethics and collaborate on research about ethical issues in medicine. By the late 1960s, these cross-disciplinary conversations had advanced enough that they were institutionalized through the creation of ethics think tanks. Around the same time, there was a rise in the number of courses being taught in medical ethics across the U.S. Throughout the 1980s and 1990s, medical schools increasingly began to incorporate ethics education into their curricula. And by 2002, 79% of medical schools offered a formal ethics course. Today, all U.S. medical schools must provide training in ethics to retain accreditation.
A similar scaling up of research ethics education happened around the same time. In 1989, the NIH began requiring graduate students on training grants to receive training in the responsible conduct of research. And in 1999, the NIH began requiring every investigator applying for NIH funding to do human subjects research to have research ethics training. Research institutions now collectively spend millions of dollars each year providing ethics training internally, as well as outsourcing this training to private companies.
Despite the time and resources spent, evidence on the impact of ethics education is relatively sparse. Although there is evidence that educating medical students in ethics can lead to more sophisticated ethical reasoning on tests, it is difficult to know whether such education leads to improved behavior in clinical and research settings, where practitioners are frequently not observed and often face barriers to making good decisions, like fatigue, limited time, institutional barriers, and cultures that obscure the ethical stakes of their decisions.
Moreover, there are significant costs associated with ethics education. Some back-of-the-envelope math suggests U.S. medical students may collectively accrue more than $100 million of debt each year studying ethics. This is to say nothing of the costs associated with having clinicians teach ethics courses rather than care for patients, conduct research, or engage in other valuable activities, and the costs associated with having medical students study ethics rather than other important topics. Conversely, if these courses are successfully training students to become ethical practitioners, then the strategies medical schools are using could potentially be imported to other professional spheres.
In light of all of this, it's worth thinking systematically about what the goals of professional ethics education should be and how we can measure whether we're achieving them. We've been talking so far as if the ultimate goal or the only goal of ethics education is to promote more ethical behavior. But there's actually quite a controversy about this. The most significant document on the goals of ethics education in higher education was produced by the Hastings Center, an interdisciplinary ethics think tank, in 1980. And in an accompanying report, Daniel Callahan, one of the center's founders, laid out what he thought were the legitimate goals or objectives of ethics education, as well as what he took to be illegitimate or doubtful goals. Among the legitimate goals were developing students' analytical and reasoning skills, helping students recognize ethical issues, and helping them tolerate and reduce disagreement and ambiguity. Meanwhile, the doubtful goals included changing behavior or influencing conduct, as well as instilling certain virtues or character traits.
Callahan opposed behavior change as a goal of ethics education for several reasons. Some were practical. For instance, he recognized that it's hard to see how an ethics course could ever have long-term sustained impact on students' behavior, given the other influences and pressures they were likely to encounter later on. And he noted that students typically take these courses before they ever have an opportunity to behave as a practitioner in their profession. So there is no existing pattern of behavior to change.
However, some of his concerns were more fundamental. Callahan believed that, quote, the whole point of an ethics course would seem to be that of inquiring into what should count as good behavior. The purpose of an ethics course, that of critical inquiry, would be begged by a pre-established blueprint of what will count as acceptable moral behavior. With respect to behavior, the most important goal is that of providing the student with those ingredients of ethical analysis and self-criticism such that he would, if the analysis seemed to require it, both recognize the importance of changing behavior and be prepared to change. The question is not whether courses should automatically change behavior, but whether the course would help a student to know the importance of changing his or her behavior, if that was what a moral judgment seemed to entail. It is not change per se that should be the goal, but the potentiality for change as a result of ethical analysis and judgment.
There are ways in which we agree with Callahan. There is often some disagreement about what the right thing to do is, and it's important to equip students with tools to think through these issues and come to conclusions that fall within the range of the reasonable. It's also important that students can articulate their reasoning clearly and systematically so they can persuade and teach others to do the same. However, there are also aspects of his view we question. For one thing, we think it's in line with the goals of ethics education to teach a, quote, pre-established blueprint of what counts as moral behavior, when that blueprint is consensus within the field. Here it's relevant that Callahan was writing about ethics education in higher education broadly, while we are primarily thinking about medical ethics and research ethics education, for which there are well-established codes and guidelines. Even when there is no consensus about what is the single best answer to a question in bioethics, there is often consensus on what falls within the range of reasonable answers, and we think it's important to teach students that there are wrong answers and explain why they fall outside that range.
Moreover, we may be more skeptical than Callahan about the motivational power of moral reasoning. Sometimes philosophical arguments can change your behavior. You might become convinced, for example, by Peter Singer's arguments in his influential article Famine, Affluence, and Morality, that we have strong moral duties to prevent the suffering of distant strangers because you accept the analogy that he draws between being able to save a drowning child in a pond in front of you, something you should obviously do, and being able to save a distant stranger from a similar amount of suffering. But encountering an ethical argument is often not enough for genuine, long-lasting behavior change. Other things often make a bigger difference, like identifying moral exemplars, encountering stories and images, finding community and accountability in others, and engaging in purposeful self-reflection and practice. Callahan infers from this that behavior change should not be one of our goals, but we think ethics education can provide some of these other tools, and that to the extent it can, it should.
The fact that people have struggled to agree on what the goal of ethics education should be makes it hard to evaluate these courses, but there are a few reasons to think that it's particularly important to understand and evaluate ethics curricula. First, unlike other topics you might learn about in medical school, say renal physiology, everyone comes in with some background in ethics. We all have a sense of what is right and what is wrong and what kinds of things doctors, researchers, and other professionals should and shouldn't do. So we shouldn't just assume that practitioners would behave unethically or reason poorly about ethical issues without formal ethics training. Second, people who know ethics about as well as anyone, moral philosophers, don't necessarily behave better. For instance, professional ethicists don't donate more to charity or call their mothers more often than non-ethicists. So if promoting ethical behavior is one of the goals of professional ethics courses, we should question whether these courses have this effect. Finally, time and resources within professional school curricula are extremely limited. Many students will take only a single course in ethics, rendering it impossible to impart all the lessons we might ideally hope to. Thus, we often need to decide what skills to prioritize when teaching ethics, since we may not be able to ensure that every student graduates knowing by heart the relevant ethical codes, reasoning like Socrates, and fully committed to living a moral life.
For today's episode, we decided to speak with Dr. Christopher Robichaud. Chris is a philosopher and senior lecturer in ethics and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's also director of pedagogical innovation at Harvard's Edmund and Lilly Safra Center for Ethics, where he co-runs the Ethics Pedagogy Fellowship Program, a program I've been part of for about a year. Chris's work at the Kennedy School focuses primarily on developing ethics pedagogy for professional policymakers. As you'll hear in the interview, he thinks about pedagogical methods and the goals of ethics education broadly. He has led efforts to incorporate more case-based learning and storytelling into the ethics curriculum, has devoted significant time and energy to creating simulations, which give professionals opportunities to practice ethical decision-making under pressure, and has taught and designed courses that place the goal of character development front and center. Chris received a PhD in philosophy from MIT.
We were interested in talking to Chris in part because he, like us, is worried about approaches to ethics pedagogy that focus exclusively on the goal of improving students' moral reasoning skills and neglect goals like improving their character. We talk with him about what motivates this focus on moral reasoning, how it might be detrimental, what other things we should supplement it with, and how we might measure success, among other topics.
With that said, let's get into the interview. As always, you can access the papers we reference at our website, biounethical.com, and you can submit feedback there or email us at biounethical@gmail.com.
Welcome to the podcast, Chris. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So today we're going to be talking about ethics education. Every year, professional school students spend thousands of hours in ethics courses. For instance, medical schools are required to provide training in medical ethics. Graduate programs often include courses pertaining to the ethical conduct of research and so on. Presumably, the driving idea here is that we can teach people how to be more ethical doctors, researchers, policymakers, and practitioners through these courses. And this just seems like a really powerful tool. If you can just teach people to be ethical, then presumably we can apply this pretty broadly and make society better in all sorts of ways by just helping people understand what they should and shouldn't do. But there are also some fundamental questions lurking in the background here. Do these courses work? What would it even mean for them to? What pedagogical methods might be most conducive to the realization of these classes' educational goals? And how might we know when we're succeeding?
Maybe a good place to start would be with what we mean by ethics education. So could you just tell us a little bit about what you include under that umbrella?
Sure. And I actually want to go back a little bit. By the time we get to university, ethics education is its own thing. But when you ask most people, I'm guessing, what do you think of ethics education? They're not going to say, oh, this amazing course on Kant or this really cool bioethics course. They're going to say, well, I think what you mean is training kids to be good people, training young people to know right or wrong. I think we all know in some sense what ethics education is because we've been exposed to it from the start. We're little sieves when we're growing up and we're modeling the behavior that we see around us. And our parents, our teachers, our friends, coaches, they're all molding us. That can be religious or that can be secular, but that's happening. So the first thing I think of when I think of ethics education is that actually. By the time folks come to university, they have gone through all of that. And by the time they're 18 or 19 years old or in their 20s for professional school, they've spent a lot of time thinking about right and wrong. And so when I then think about ethics education in higher education, I pivot to thinking about, all right, well, what can we do with folks like that, that they're already well indoctrinated into the moral practice, as it were? Can we make folks more ethical? What does that even mean in the context that I've just described? Does it mean making them more of what they already want to be? Does it mean challenging what they think is right or wrong and perhaps complicating it? Does it mean all of the above? Does it mean cultivating virtues? Does it mean teaching them moral theories? So I'm meandering around an answer to your question of what do I think of when I think of university ethics education, but I think of it as the next stage of ethics education that includes but is not exhausted by things like moral theorizing, challenging what one might already think is right or wrong or good or bad or what a virtuous person looks like, and then also showing how ethical problems can emerge from a certain professional context.
Yeah, this is obviously a very broad topic. And you teach primarily ethics at a public policy school. So perhaps it makes sense for us to focus on the topic of ethics education for practitioners. That is, for people whose ultimate goal is not to become a moral philosopher, but instead to do something else where they're perhaps navigating ethical issues in the course of doing their day job. Do you have a sense of when professional school curricula started to include ethics and why they did that?
I do. So I think some professional schools before, and I don't know the specifics of this, but they certainly had classes on here's what the law profession has decided is, you know, appropriate in practicing law, or the medical profession as well. But as I remember it or recall, Harvard is one of the places that started this. And in the 70s, there was a lot of anxiety about what professional schools were doing, what kind of people they were producing. When you had Watergate, when you had people that were in positions of power, really sort of flubbing it, really sort of falling on their face, what are we doing here was the thought. And so Derek Bach, President Derek Bach, really was one of the people that said, we need to take much more seriously embedding ethics into professional schools, showing how really interesting ethical issues emerge from the practice of this, that, or the other thing, and wrestling with the practicality of it. He wasn't alone, but he was one of the first movers in this space. I think fortunately, it led to a lot of great things. Unfortunately, we're still posed with this question, what are we producing? You know, because we still have a lot of folks who seem to be flubbing it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, another anxiety that I think people have, which is perhaps more fundamental, is that ethics education just as an enterprise sort of misses the point. So a lot of people, for instance, don't think that educating the police about ethics is the best way to lead to more ethical policing. The best way to address systemic issues is not by teaching individual practitioners to make better choices or sort of weeding out bad apples. And you might even worry that focusing on ethics education allows institutions to band-aid over bigger structural problems by pointing to the fact that, you know, they provide ethics education or they hire people who have training in ethics. So I guess we're wondering, do you share this concern about ethics education just not being the right way to address the problem of unethical behavior?
I wouldn't say that it's missing the point. I would say that it's profoundly incomplete. I wouldn't want to be advocating for removing ethics training from our police force. I wouldn't want to be advocating for removing ethics training from lawyering or doctoring or the practice of politics. But we are more aware of systemic issues, and we are aware that alone is probably not going to do it. Structural interventions are very important. Incentive structures, looking at what incentives people are responding to. There's an entire branch now, behavioral ethics, that is really trying to look at just this issue. What is the incentive structure in an organization, say? What is the incentive structure even in a profession? And how might that be pulling someone towards behaving a certain way versus a different sort of way? If your incentive structure in politics is to raise money because you're in a constant state of having to raise money because you're not going to win re-election if you don't, that's obviously going to have a lot of downstream ethical consequences for what you spend your morning, noon, and night doing. Does that mean that we shouldn't also train people going to these professions to think a little bit more substantially about the ethical dimensions of their practice? No. But we really, I think, have had our eyes open. That is going to be insufficient. On the other side of it, though, I would say, I also don't think it's sufficient just to do behavioral ethics. Because, to me at least, a background assumption of behavioral ethics is, here's some things that we all know are wrong, and what we want to try to do is get people to behave better so that they don't do these wrong things. Really important. But a lot of what we want to train professionals in these spaces is to also explore the things for which it's not obvious what the right thing to do is. And that's not something that behavioral ethics alone is going to do. So yes to structural intervention, yes to behavioral ethics, but also yes to the project of educating people to engage in better, more reasoning.
Yeah, that seems consistent with the fact that I think, at least in medical education, a lot of the impetus for doing ethics education emerged from the fact that there were these new problems that were arising enabled by novel technologies, where things like brain death became a category where previously that wouldn't have existed. And so I think a lot of professional schools responded by saying like, okay, well, this is clearly something we need to be talking about. We need to be training our future doctors to think through these kinds of complicated moral issues. And there was unanimity in the recognition that like, this is something that needs to happen. But one thing that's also kind of striking is that ethics curricula vary immensely in terms of their objectives, how much time is devoted to them, when during training students complete this training, who teaches these courses, what content they cover, how students are assessed, the list goes on. And so although there might be sort of consensus in the recognition that we need to be doing this, there's this immense diversity in how these courses are actually taught. Is that your sense that across the board, there's just this diversity in terms of what we're doing when we do ethics education?
For sure. And I'm not at all certain it's a bad thing per se. We're still in the space of trying to figure out what's the best way to educate this next generation of individuals who are in professional practice. No one has completely figured that out yet. And as we just talked about earlier, we don't even know exactly what our goals are. I don't think it's a bad thing. Our goals are multifaceted. So if my goal is to get you to change your character, that's going to be a different kinds of educational intervention. If my goal is to get you to be able to think more clearly about these things. So I don't think it's a bad thing that there's a lack of uniformity. I do worry that if it's just all of us all the time throwing spaghetti in the wall, seeing what sticks, there are going to be some folks coming out of an educational session with a lot and others who have little.
I think this is a good place to transition to talking a bit more concretely about what the possible goals of ethics education are. I know that you've been thinking about this lately, and we've been talking about them also in the Ethics Pedagogy Fellowship Program. And so far, we've been finding it useful to divide the landscape into four kinds of goals or four skills that you might be trying to cultivate in students when you're teaching them ethics. These are first, sound ethical reasoning, second, ethical behavior, third, ethical or moral perception, and fourth, a commitment to living an ethically good life. We're going to get into each of these goals more, but could you just briefly introduce us to the categories and what they mean?
Sure. I think these categories emerged as we were looking at the landscape of how ethics is being taught and asking ourselves, all right, there can't be one, I'm a geek, so I'm going to make a reference to Lord of the Rings here. There can't be one ethics course to rule them all. And trying to do that is going to set you up for failure. So let's step back and let's think about what we want to accomplish when we're teaching ethics. And from that emerge these four categories. The one that's most familiar to people in university settings, moral reasoning. Of course, moral reasoning, moral reasoning. I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that moral reasoning would show up on that list. Behavior is similar to what I was talking about with behavioral ethics. Like, how do we get people to actually do the right thing? Even if the right thing is just based on what they think is the right thing. There's a bridge, as we all know, between me saying this is the right thing to do and me doing the right thing. So how do we maybe give some training in that space as well? Moral perception is awareness. Are we seeing all of the moral landscape? I know this is metaphorical, but are we seeing all the moral landscape that we ought to be seeing? And last is this deep old question that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. What is the best way to live? What is the purpose of it all? What is a worthwhile life? These categories are distinct, but obviously blend into each other. And you could offer a course, I imagine, that touches on all of them a little bit. But one of our hopes in putting them front and center is to give educators and students some guidance on what are you really trying to do here? Let's think about the best tools for doing that thing.
Presumably, the goals that we should try to realize through ethics education should depend to some extent on why people are making ethically suboptimal decisions and what kinds of decisions they tend to err on. And you might think that any number of things could be going on here. Like, it's possible that they know what they should be doing but face barriers to doing it, or they know what they should be doing but aren't sufficiently motivated to do it. Or perhaps they don't know what they should be doing, or they're not recognizing when they're in situations where they're making ethical decisions. And presumably the answer to that question of why people are getting these things wrong should drive our ethics education to some extent. So what do you see as the main reasons practitioners don't behave ethically, and how does that inform how you think about the goals of ethics education?
I'm going to complicate it a little bit. I'm sorry. how do we get people to do what they should be doing? That's already, to me, well on our way, because sometimes we don't know what we should be doing. When I'm thinking about medical ethics, for instance, there was this case of Dax, this kid. I don't know if they ever mentioned the case of Dax, but he was burned over most of his body, and there was a medical treatment to keep him alive for quite some time. He kept refusing care. And part of the question there was just, well, what should we do? You know, there's some really good reasoning on both sides. So I don't want to say that everything is like this, but I really worry about saying everything is like this. But I do think that a full answer to your question has to include the fact that one of the questions going into ethics training is, how do we help people think about what they should do when it's not obvious what should be done, when reasonable people can reasonably disagree? On the other hand, when we more or less converge on what should be done and folks still aren't doing it, then we have the set of questions that you raised. And you laid out many reasons, and some of those reasons are going to be targetable in an ethics class, and some of them are not going to be. If one of the reasons is because of the incentive structure of an organization, you can name that in an ethics class, but you're going to need the organizational theory change in order to actually change that.
Yes, I totally accept what you're saying about there are the ethical dilemmas where we roughly know what should happen, and it's just a question of how we get there. And then there are the ones where actually we don't know what the right thing is to do here. And I guess I think that at least in the medical context, most of the cases that practitioners actually are going to face are going to be of the former kind. You know, we know what an informed consent ought to look like. We know what a capacity assessment ought to look like. And it's just a question of doing it well. And the DAX type cases where it's just really complicated are maybe once in a career type situations. And so my sense from that is that it does make sense to focus primarily on the former set of cases. I'm wondering, like, would you say the same thing applies to the policy space as well?
I definitely think it doesn't apply to the policy world. Policy by its very nature is contentious. Politics by its very nature is contentious. What counts as justice by its very nature is contentious. So this is a space I think that's just rife with big question marks. What's not contentious is things like, do you use your campaign funds for personal gain? No. So I do think that there is still some room here to talk about those. We all know what should be done. But there's so much, to me, interesting terrain, like you're working for a president, and maybe going public with some of the things that they're doing is a compelling thing to do because you're not happy with some of the things that you're doing. But if everyone did that, presidencies wouldn't function anymore because there is a degree of loyalty that's required. And the overall arc of their presidency is a good one. What do you do? People immediately volunteer and answer, oh, you should definitely do this or definitely do that. That automatic response to me is what I would push back on. Be like, let's just think about this a little bit. It's not clear to me what ought to be done. And even if it is clear what ought to be done, the means of getting there are often complicated. So I don't think we should shy away from the times when with relief we can know what should be done. And the hard question is just, how do we get ourselves to do that? But there's a lot more complexity and nuance at times that I think folks maybe even have a patience to tolerate.
You mentioned that the goals that we've been talking about bleed together. They're not mutually exclusive, and there might be courses that address multiple of them. We're wondering if you think that there is any kind of priority ranking within the goals and that some of them are only instrumentally important. For example, you might think that it's important to cultivate moral perception because it would lead practitioners to make more ethical decisions and behave ethically more of the time. Do you think that each of these goals is independently valuable, or are sound ethical reasoning, ethical perception, and commitment to living an ethical life only important as means to promoting more ethical behavior?
That's a great question. I haven't settled on that. I myself tend to orient my thinking around a broadly virtue perspective. And a broadly virtue perspective is not just satisfied with getting the behavior right. It's really important that you reasoned the right way, that you saw things accurately. It's a package deal. I'm also a virtue epistemologist, meaning just that I think that when we think about the value of knowledge and of understanding these sorts of things, it reduces to intellectual virtues. I don't think knowledge is instrumental either is what I'm trying to say. So moral perception, for instance, which to me would be a kind of knowing, is not only instrumentally valuable, even though it is instrumentally valuable. All this is by way of me saying that I have no worked out strong views on this yet. I do worry, though, about two things. One, I worry that education in this space has not focused enough on getting us to do the right thing when that's something that's pretty straightforward about what that is and should improve there. But I wouldn't want to swing the pendulum all the way in the other direction either and say, all right, we got everyone to do that. There's lots of ways you can get people to do the right thing through coercion, you know, through fear. We wouldn't be satisfied with that either. No one's proposing that. But the point is, it's not just enough to get people to land in the right spot, even when we all agree what that right spot is. We genuinely think in the space that we want you to be able to think about these things. We want you to be able to be virtuous, which was more than just behaving correctly.
I see. Yeah, that's interesting. I expected that you would say that about the virtue ethics perspective, but what you got to at the end there was that even if you don't have that perspective, these other goals might be important because of the limitations that we have on how we can permissibly make people act. So let's zoom in now on the first of these goals. Improving moral reasoning seems to be the focus of many, many ethics courses. It's also the goal that people seem to think is most important and seem most comfortable with. Do you share the view that teaching moral reasoning ought to be our primary goal?
It's a great question. I go back and forth on this. But in terms of moral reasoning, I would divide that into a lot of things as well. To me, part of moral reasoning is moral theorizing, where what we're teaching learners to do is to actually get inside a moral system, a theory. And I understand theory. I don't want to roll out any one particular definition, but I understand it as really looking for first principles, taking a nod from the sciences, sort of Enlightenment style. Let's try to find one or a handful of principles that we think do all the work and show how everything flows from that and the system supports itself and is independently justifiable. But I wouldn't want everyone to hear moral reasoning as just moral theorizing, because a tremendous amount of moral reasoning doesn't involve theorizing like that explicitly. A lot of it involves leaning on some principles or surfacing some principles that are embedded in the background, but also having those principles informed by experience in the moment and just trying to figure out at the end of the day, reason your way towards what ought I do in this situation. That to me, the ability to offer reasons for what one concludes and offer reasons that are compelling to yourself, but also that someone else could take up, I do think that's important. And last, I think that moral reasoning and being explicit about it can be a way of moral transformation of one's views. You might discover that you actually have bad reasons for what you're doing or that they don't hold up under scrutiny. And I don't think that always changes things, or even most of the time changes things, but maybe once in a while it changes things. The last thing I'll just say is, and this is maybe more of an article of faith, I think that a lot of our moral behavior is more changed and motivated by experience and perception than it is by reasoning. But without the reasoning there, it can be fragile. I don't think many people reasoned their way towards treating animals more respectively, more than just looking at pictures of the brutality towards animals. That moves you faster. But if you can't offer reasons as well, then that experience is fleeting. It goes into memory and it can be overcome pretty easily.
Yeah, that strikes me as totally right. One thing that we're interested in is what factors drive the idea that teaching people to reason well ethically is the only, or at least the primary goal of ethics education. An obvious candidate is concern about indoctrination. So the worry that if we're doing anything other than teaching people to think for themselves about ethics and values, then we might be brainwashing them essentially, or indoctrinating them with values in a way that's inherently at odds with a liberal vision of what education is. And this is an old worry, of course, one that's tied up with the history of ethics education and with the fact that character development did used to be seen as a central goal of higher education at a time when the values that were being taught were often explicitly religious and the populations they were being taught to were extremely homogenous by design in problematic ways. But it's not just an old worry. We see it come up a lot right now in debates about whether anti-racism education should be part of the college curriculum and things like that. So I guess our question is, to what extent do you think that people place emphasis on moral reasoning because they're worried about indoctrination and because they want to teach people how to think, but never what to think?
I don't know if that's explicit. I really just think it depends. I think in university settings, in a typical philosophy class, yes, certainly moral reasoning allows oneself to sort of come in and not take a stand on anything, just train people to say, look, this is how you would weigh arguments back and forth. But I think that many of the things that go under the heading moral reasoning could very much be embedded within one moral framework. But then again, you're looking at someone who went through 16 years of Catholic schooling. There was a lot of moral reasoning, and it was not to look at different perspectives. It was very much to show how to reason as a Catholic towards certain conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I guess another candidate explanation is much more practical and I guess more boring, which is just that ethics education is often conducted by philosophers, and philosophers are most used to and maybe most qualified to teach moral reasoning. Do you think that plays a role?
I don't know. I mean, I think that philosophers are good at a certain kind of argumentation. And I think that kind of argumentation lends itself to a certain kind of moral reasoning. And I think it's a very good thing to have that and your toolkit. Sorry for me to put it this way, when one's navigating the world. But it is not the only way. I mean, to me, moral reasoning is at least potentially broad enough to include reading a novel from Iris Murdoch. And to suggest that is not a kind of moral reasoning where you are experiencing people wrestling with hard issues and their characters and their decisions and working through what you think what they did was right or wrong and how it applies to you. And I choose her because, of course, she was a very well-trained philosopher as well, in addition to a great novelist. That, to me, is as much that novel and reading that novel and talking about that novel can be as productive as here are the premises and here are the conclusions, or here's the system and here's the result of it. All of this is by way of me saying that I think the philosophers clearly have a lot to contribute, but we have perhaps inadvertently narrowed the scope of what counts as good moral reasoning or good moral thinking or good moral training by leaning on the things that we are best comfortable with and most trained to do and missing a lot in doing so.
Yeah, that makes sense. It seems like one worry you might have about focusing so heavily on improving moral reasoning is that these courses may veer into the territory of endorsing some strong version of relativism. So one thing I've seen ethics exams say often is something like, your answer will be graded on how well you justify it, regardless of what position you argue, which maybe seems fine for an exam. But when we're talking about practitioners who are going to go out and take care of patients or do research or make policies and so on, that starts to feel a little more sus. The worry here is that you risk imparting to students this meta principle that there aren't right or wrong answers in ethics, and they just need to be able to justify or rationalize them sufficiently. Do you think this is an inherent risk of focusing too much on moral reasoning and too little on ethical choice or behavior?
It can be, for sure. The risk that you point to is one that I've encountered with many of my students who come to me halfway through the semester, and at first they start saying things you want to hear as a philosopher, which is, I'm doubting everything. You're like, all right, well, we're well on our way, right? But then they're like, it's all relative. And you're like, oh no, I've only got 6 weeks to work on this. What do I do? Relativism is a threat, especially if the framing of certain things, like you mentioned on exam, is we're not interested in what's right or wrong. We're just interested in your justification, if that's the beginning, middle, and the end. But a couple of things. One is, I think that intellectual humility is really important in this space. I don't think intellectual humility and relativism need to be walking hand in hand. I like to tell students often, it could be the case that there's no right answer here. It could be the case that there is and we don't know it. Now, there's some meta-ethics going on in the background, but I do think that humility is crucial to making progress in this space. One of the things I try to teach professionals is most professional decision-making in the space of morality is going to be making decisions under conditions of significant uncertainty. And you need to become comfortable with that. And feeling certain that something is morally right or wrong, you might be right, but often you have not earned that. Often the reason that you have that feeling is because you haven't thought about it enough. The other thing is, I'm deeply convinced that all of us are quite embedded in a particular way of looking at the world morally. And the offering of moral reasons, the engagement of justification, can expand that. This is talking about moral perception here for a little bit. The metaphor I often use for my students is, imagine we're in an art class, we all go to a window, the instructor says, take a look out here and draw what you see. We know how this exercise is going to go. Folks are going to draw a whole bunch of different things. Some are going to focus on the colors, and others the shapes, and others the mood, and others are going to try to get as accurate representation of this, that, or the other thing. And it's all not wrong in the sense that they're all capturing some aspect of this extremely complicated scene. But they're all primed to look or focus on one thing or another. And then we ask, all right, we want to take in this scene in its fullness. Well, how do I do that? Well, I'm going to be holding my picture next to other people's pictures, and I'm going to be looking at how everyone is taking this in, and now I'm going to be expanding my understanding of what we're capturing when we're looking out there. I think that morality is much the same way. And so that process of justification can collapse into relativism, which would be unfortunate. It can sometimes get us to not see the morally obvious. Those are problematic things, but it can also really get us to get outside of our own heads and expand the things that morally matter for us in our deliberation.
Moving now from talking about ethical reasoning to talking more about ethical behavior, we've spoken about how in different contexts there's more or less certainty about what the right thing to do is. In some fields, there's general consensus on how, for example, clinicians or researchers should resolve many of the issues that they will regularly encounter. And specifically, there are established codes of ethics to follow in these areas. So in those contexts, given the very limited time that we often have to teach students or practitioners, what do you think of just focusing on the codes of ethics and almost just teaching students the codes and testing how well they know what the code says and how well they follow the professional norms?
I think that's going to help a little, but this is really where I would want the behavioral ethicist to come in. Why? Because, look, I, again, I'm going to use a religious analog, right? I could have recited for you at by the age of 8, because I had the fear of God put into me if I couldn't, the Ten Commandments. These are the things you do and don't do. Did I follow them all the time? Heck no. In fact, I started to take delight in breaking some of them, right? This is our human nature. Knowing is part, but not nearly enough. So if it's the case that a profession says, look, this is an area in which we have all reached consensus, this is what we're expecting you to do, I think then it is totally fine to spend some of your time making really sure people get what that is. That, unfortunately, is now maybe one half, maybe not even, of the battle. So what we need to do is put you into situations in which you feel pressure against that and see how you react. Because, and this is David Wiggins who said this, I'm going to give you a paraphrase of the quote, but it was, everyone thinks that if we didn't have these morally binding laws, that it would be Hobbesian, it'd be Mad Max, we'd just all be villains. He says, that's not really what people, I mean, some people would be, but mostly it's not that we want to be bad. It's that we want being good to be really easy. And so understanding what, in this sense, agreed upon practice is, this is what's right and wrong, this is what's good and bad, that's half of it. But now we've got to show people what happens when it's not easy to do this. Because if it's easy, I don't think there's any training required whatsoever. If people understand what to do and it's super easy to do it, everyone's going to do it, or at least most people are going to do it most of the time. Most of the time that we get these failures, my first question is, what was going on that was pulling them in different directions?
I think you're right that like a major cause of people behaving unethically is just that they want behaving ethically to be easy, and it's often not. And one reason I think this is like, if you were to go out and talk to your friends about whether they think that they're an ethical person, probably all of them would say yes. But presumably, one third of your friends are the least ethical third, and probably none of them have insight into the fact that they're in that third. And probably a lot of this has to do with the fact that they think that ethical behavior is an easy thing to do, and they're just doing it, when in fact, a lot of the stuff that would allow us to behave more ethically is really hard. And so I guess one thing you might think that is driving this misconception is just that people don't realize they're doing unethical stuff. I think there's some evidence to suggest this. So we know, for example, that 87% of physicians deny knowingly or mistakenly behaving poorly as a physician, but more than half of them report seeing other physicians behave inappropriately. Does this kind of data make you think that improving moral perception, which might include making practitioners more aware of their own moral failings or how hard it is to be ethical sometimes, is an important part of the puzzle?
For sure. That's part of it, is just that awareness. It's interesting when you said, yes, most people think you're ethical. I think most people would say yes, but they just haven't done induction well. And this is something that I'll mention even when I'm teaching in the ER to the undergrads. They're 18, 19 years old. Every generation thinks that it has captured the moral complexity of a situation. And let's just grant moral progress. We're actually moving in the right direction. To me, it's more interesting if you grant it. All you have to do is watch films from the 30s, and you see the behavior of people, and you're like, what is going on? And then you see films that I grew up on in the 80s, and you watch them now, and you're like, what is going on? And then you say, well, we got it right now. That's bad induction. A moment's induction should at least have the thought, the non-trivial thought, that right now we are engaged in morally questionable practices, and we don't see it. We should, I think, recognize on a regular basis that there might be really important aspects of moral reality that for social reasons and or cultural reasons and or whatever, we're missing. And maybe future generations will have aligned to reveal it, but we're not there yet.
Right. Like you said, it feels like an important piece here is heightening people's moral perception. And one worry I have about ethics courses is that they can actually do the opposite, by focusing on cases that are interesting and fun, but where it is super obvious that something ethically complicated is going on. So for example, in medical curricula, I think often what we talk about when we talk about resource allocation is things like allocation of ventilators during a pandemic or allocation of ECMO machines. And in practice, most doctors aren't ever going to be allocating ventilators. What they're going to be allocating is their time and their attention and these sort of more mundane things that don't scream like, this is an ethical situation. So I guess I worry that the ethical dilemmas covered in curricula may often be quite unlike the cases practitioners will encounter in real life. So do you think the situation is the same in the public policy curriculum? And if so, do you worry that by focusing on these exciting but often really morally shocking cases that we risk dulling people's moral perception?
It's a great thing to think about. I have a couple of responses. The first is, one of the things that we've tried to do at the Kennedy School is to offer, for example, in a class that's based on cases, a whole swath of different protagonists. So you'll get one case, which is someone who's just starting off in their career, and you'll get another case where it's the mayor of a city, and you'll get another case where it's the leader of a country. And the point of doing that is, in some sense, to push against the, you're a leader and you're in this dramatic role, and here's this dramatic decision, and say, look, at any point in your career, whether you're just starting off or whether you've now risen to this rank or whether you're just part of a large organization, here are some interesting ethical issues. The second thing, though, is it depends to me in part on what you do with the revelations from some of what you describe as the more shocking things in terms of moral perception. So I designed a simulation called Liberty Hospital. It's one bad day in the life of a hospital. You're on the ethics board. You have to make some really hard decisions. And it's all emergency. It's all crisis. It's all drama. It's all like the old television show 24. And if I just left it at that, as I tell people who go through it, I'm like, well, this would be not useful. I hope no one goes through any of these decisions, and most of you aren't even in the medical world. It's what we do with the insights gained from it. For instance, one of them is a distribution problem, you know, who gets the life-saving stuff. And when debriefing it, the debrief is really important. I often point to things like ventilators, right? And in the simulation, most people reason like consequentialists for lots of reasons. And I'll use the ventilators and I'll use what happened. I think it was here in Boston or thereabouts, which was decisions were made about ventilators that made a lot of sense from a fairly straightforward consequentialist standpoint. If we run out of ventilators, give them to the people who are most likely to live or something like that. The consequence of that was people with comorbidities were deprioritized. The consequence of that was a lot of communities of color ended up being deprioritized. And that's because they have comorbidities, and those comorbidities are due to structural issues. And the lesson to extract from that, or at least one of the lessons, is, well, what this shows you is how, one, sometimes perfectly reasonable consequentialist reasoning can actually exacerbate injustice when put into an unjust system. And more, most people didn't even think of it. And that's a lesson that can become very practical. You didn't even see it. That, I think, you can show if you do a debrief right or with a case like this right, just how important it is to bring so many different perspectives and voices into a situation, because we're just, this goes back to what I said before, we're just locked in on seeing things a certain way.
When it comes to the fourth goal, we've glossed this as a commitment to living an ethical life or increasing the extent to which students live out their values. As you mentioned up top, though, when students come to us, they have already had extensive moral training, and we have no control over what that training looked like. If people lack the other skills that we've been talking about, like critical reasoning or moral perception, do you think that increasing their commitment to their values is just going to backfire? I worry about this sometimes when I encounter integrity courses or modules within leadership programs, because at least on some probably mistaken ways of thinking about integrity, you could be a person with great integrity and just not be living an ethical life at all.
Yeah, it's a fascinating concern, right? And I like that you mentioned integrity, because I teach integrity in my class. One of the models of integrity we'll look at, which we criticize, is you can be a person of great integrity who's a Nazi on some models of what integrity is. You have this principle. You're totally committed to it. No one's going to like change your mind. Now, I'm of the view that is not ultimately integrity, but we have a loose enough conception there where we could make sense of what I've just said. Without some reflection, without some moral reasoning, without some critical thinking about this, some of these categories are going to seem to go off the rails pretty quickly. How does one even decide what is a life worth living without engaging in moral reasoning, for instance, without moral perception? And that's why I said that there's a bit of bleeding into each other when it comes to these things. But the reason I think that's a worthwhile category unto itself is because you could, and in fact I have and others have, gone through an entire course on ethics and never asked the question, like, what's the best way to live? You just end up with, well, here's a theory of what makes actions right or wrong, or here's these puzzle cases, or I've expanded my perception. I realize that I'm embedded in a society and a culture and a place, and I don't see certain things. And all of that's really good, but I've not spent any time thinking about the life I ought to be living. So I don't think we can answer that question, how ought one live, ultimately, without drawing on some of these other things. But I think it deserves to be put on its own place because it is often missed. And I don't think it's an accident, by the way, that's missed at university. Universities are liberal and pluralistic, and it seems pretentious to come in and say, here's the best way to live. But you can see a corollary in the professional schools. It may not be the broader one, what is the best way to live, but what is the best way to doctor? What is the best way to lawyer? How do I want this profession to be a part of my life? What part does it play in my life? Is it my whole life? Is my identity wrapped up in it? Is it just my day job? Like, those are serious questions that aren't, I mean, how often does medical school have a class on situating your profession in a life worth living? I hope some.
Never.
Never, right. Right. But that's really important because that is not just an abstract question. At some point, you're going to be tired. You're going to be trying to either build a family or build a bunch of friendships or go travel the world or do a whole bunch of other things. And you're going to be wrestling with, where do I want to put this profession in my life? And wouldn't it be nice if some schools spent some time giving you some thinking about that, or at least creating space for that kind of thing?
That's actually really interesting that you reference medical schools there, because I think one way that medical schools try to do this is they sort of almost invert the equation. So they'll have these like professionalism statements that will be unbelievably broad. Like, they'll include stuff like taking care of your own health is a professional obligation, or knowing right from wrong, or being honest, or dressing appropriately, or being appropriate on social media, and so on and so forth. And it's saying, here's how you should live your life, subsumed under the header of, these are all professional obligations of physicians, which feels a little fraught. And maybe we should just save this discussion for a different day. But
it's very fraught.
Yeah, we'll just say it's fraught and move on. Yeah, so I think it's worth talking a bit more about strategies for achieving some of these goals that we've been discussing. So I'd like to hear your thought on what pedagogical strategies and methods we might use to achieve the goals of ethics education, and how we might know if we're succeeding.
The how we know we're succeeding is really, really, really tough. We do want to measure success. I don't think it's impossible. But there are times when I'm in a more Aristotelian mood. Like, did someone live a good life? I don't know. First, they've got to like die. And that's not meant to be morbid. Like, I've got to like literally see the whole thing before I can even begin to assess whether they lived a good life. All right. Strategies. I am of the mind that we should do what we have been doing and more. Lecturing and professional moral reasoning, important. Cases, important. By cases, I mean professional cases in addition to puzzle cases. I like them both. Puzzle cases have their place, whether it's a trolley or something like that. But rich, embedded professional cases, here's a person or persons in this organization or doing this doctoring or doing this lawyering, I think that's very important. Simulations, to give individuals an opportunity to, in a safe, constructed setting, experiment with decision-making and absorbing consequences, looking at who we think are not saints, but exemplars in this space. I think a lot of training can be like, look, here's what good doctoring looks like. We have this person, and they're not perfect, but they did really good in this case. Be like them. Crafting contexts in which students can share their own experiences. Where have you succeeded or failed already? Surfacing those and having structured discussion of them so that you're used to sharing your successes and failures and the things that you're stumbling over. I think all of that would be useful. And how can I forget? Fiction, make-believe. We actually learn a lot that way, whether it's watching films or here's an interesting thing that happened here. Drama, we forget that a lot of ethical reasoning across cultural traditions emerges from storytelling. Storytelling has been walking next to moral thinking since we've been morally thinking. We shouldn't abandon that. It's a bit of a bummer that so many of us have.
Yeah, I like that you think of the pedagogical methods so broadly. I want to call out one particular method for some discussion. One of the most common methods for teaching ethics, both in the moral philosophy classroom and within professional schools, is what people sometimes call the applied model. It's a model that primarily teaches sound ethical reasoning and involves teaching students the contents of prominent moral theories and then having them practice applying these theories to somewhat idealized real-world cases. Usually, it involves teaching the so-called big three moral theories, utilitarianism, Kantian deontology, and virtue ethics. We're skeptical of this approach for reasons that we can get into or not, but we're wondering if you're skeptical of it and if you think that there's any place for this method in ethics pedagogy.
I do think there is. I tend to be a little bit more Deweyan about this. So Dewey didn't reject any of this moral theorizing. He was just really frustrated with people thinking that these were moral theories aimed at getting at the truth. Now, that's going to upset a lot of folks. In my classrooms at professional schools, I will distinguish frameworks from theories. It's a bit of an artificial distinction, but, and I mentioned earlier in our conversation how I think about a theory, which is you can't do theory quickly. You can't. If we're going to really look at utilitarian theory, we've got a lot of work to do because it has been developed over hundreds of years. We've got to actually evaluate it as a theory that aims at, let us dare say, a comprehensive story about what ought and ought not be done and all the rest of that. That is going to take a lot of time. But approaching these theories as frameworks, meaning they're going to orient your thinking around a certain set of things to focus on, their lenses. And knowing that there's a theory in the background with a lot of bells and whistles and maybe getting at the ultimate truth, who knows? But you don't need that to appreciate the emphases that these frameworks will call you to draw upon. I think it's really important when approaching hard moral cases in professional life to have available to you the ability to focus on what are the short, medium, and long-term consequences, to the extent that you know them, about what you're doing. And what are you counting as a consequence worth bringing into your calculation? And how are you weighing that? And is there commensurability between the things that you're weighing? I think that a lens that says focus more on motive, on duties, on consent, on rights, use those ordinary terms to begin a conversation around autonomy. I think that's a really important way to lean into a case as well. Maybe this produces the most overall consequences, but it would violate this patient's rights if we did this. What I don't like is we're going to build this little spaghetti maker, and it's called utilitarianism, and here's a case, and we're just going to put it in, and we're going to twist the little thing, and out comes a verdict. That, to me, is rather silly, but giving students enough of these theories so that they could constitute a framework that they could use alongside these other ones to help them move in and out of focusing on different portions of a moral case. It's not going to produce a verdict. In fact, it's going to frustratingly complicate what they're paying attention to. But I think that actually is pretty useful.
Okay, yeah, I'm actually totally on board with that. And in my experience, students find that approach really helpful, where you use ethical theories as ethical lenses, so to speak, or ways of seeing a situation that highlight different considerations that may or may not ultimately be ethically relevant, but are worth considering. It's essentially using ethical theories in the practice of moral perception as ways of orienting yourself toward the world.
Yeah, so it had seemed before like you weren't super excited about talking about assessment of ethics education, but I'm just terrified. We saved the terrifying part for the end. I guess to just motivate this discussion a little bit, teaching ethics in professional schools is costly. And partly this is unavoidable in that good teaching requires resources in the form of labor and training and so on. But partly it's due to how variable ethics curricula are. Like, everybody's kind of recreating the wheel, so to speak, which takes a ton of time and energy from these educators. And then, of course, there are also opportunity costs. And this is particularly salient to me within the context of medical schools, where you often have one class that's like all of the social sciences and humanities. And ethics is one component of that. But to the extent that you're teaching ethics, you're often spending less time on things like medical sociology or statistics or other things that you also think are important. So given all of this, it seems very important to know whether ethics pedagogy is effective. Have people tried to assess that?
At the Safra Center of Ethics here at Harvard, we are working on assessment models. And they do have a fair degree of sophistication, but it's very much a work in progress. These assessment models, in part, will ask instructors, what are the three main learning goals of this class? And then it will ask students at the end, without them knowing what the instructor said, what are the three main things that you learned here? And I know that's so rough, but that's a bare minimum. Here's what I said my learning goals were, and here are the things that the students were taking away, and oh, they don't align. One of the challenges to me here is you can assess knowledge. How do you assess whether you're better motivated? Nothing without a longitudinal study. Nothing without seeing how a person actually goes about their life. I mean, that's the hard thing about this is at the end of the day, we're putting people into a classroom for 3.5 months, say, and then we're sending them out for the rest of their lives. We can ask them. I don't know how much confidence we should put in that. I have had a lot. I mean, this is totally anecdotal, but it is more than one, more than 10 people come back to me and say, you know, I faced this case in my professional career and I really benefited from the discussion we had in class. But even benefiting is like, well, what does that mean exactly? Does that mean that you just weren't surprised when this thing happened? Does it mean that it helped you think through it? At the end of the day, our subject matter is living a good life, doing the right thing, being good. And that can only be assessed ultimately, in my view, longitudinally. Professional schools should be panicked with some of the people that we put out and with some of the things that they do. But then again, I mean, let's run the numbers. I mean, here are some people that have done some really bad things, but there might be a ton of people doing the right thing, and those aren't making the headlines. Now, that said, I just want to just follow it up with this. I do think that there are strategies we can adopt, but this is a place, again, where we have to be quite humble in what our goals are. I am a little bit worried that we focus sometimes too much on the negative and not see that there's probably a lot of positive that's done out there as well that just never makes it to the forefront. Anyhow, those are my initial thoughts on assessment. I guess the very last thing I'll say is I don't want to dismiss the importance of assessment or act as though ethics is beyond assessment. I just think that what would it be to assess someone's ethical training? A snapshot is never going to do it. Even a complete and total moral meltdown in one instance might be situated in a fairly decent life.
Right. I mean, I did want to follow up on one thing that you mentioned. So you said that although there might be a few people who acted really badly, we might look at the numbers and see that actually a lot of graduates of these schools acted really well a lot of the time. But in order to conclude that ethics education works, we need to know not just that students behave ethically after they take ethics classes, but that there's a meaningful difference between how they behaved before and how they behave after. When it comes to other kinds of training, it seems like we can assume that students come in with no background. For instance, most medical students come in with no background at all in managing cardiovascular disease. So we can assume that if we find they learn anything about it, then we know it will improve medical care to some extent. But as you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, students do enter our programs with ideas about how to approach ethical issues. So we kind of need to determine that ethics classes actually improve them relative to a non-zero baseline. Do you think that that gives us even stronger justification for trying to assess the efficacy of ethics courses relative to even other kinds of courses?
It could. And we can explore some strategies like, here's a case at the beginning of the semester. Here's a professional case. Morally analyze it. Give it line of reasoning. All right, now here's hopefully structurally analogous case. Maybe it's the same case. That's probably cleaner. At the end of the semester, do the same thing. I do believe that there could be, and there are, that people have developed this, ways that you can quantify things like complexity of thinking that you could mark and you could say, all right, this is progress. Since people are coming in with some ethics training, that's why I like this as an example. We're already expecting them to have something to say about the case. And if they had nothing to say, that'd be scary, right? But we can nevertheless compare it to what they are doing on the other side of it. In terms of behavior, I don't even know how to start working with the counterfactuals. They will not ever face exactly the same situations going forward that they faced in the past. So there will always be some kind of hard comparison. Here's how you behaved and wrestled with situations here, and here's how you're behaving and wrestling with situations now. I take the point, which is how in the world do you compare someone with an ethics intervention, except in the most extreme instances, they suddenly become what all of us would agree is a saint or a complete villain, given that they already had some training going in. I would lean a little on first personal testimony, but I wouldn't put too much weight on it. I would lean a little bit on trends of behavior, but that would be only over time. You always hear these cases of people, the obvious cases, I gave up meat or I gave up this or I started donating. And so long as you think that's actually the right thing to do, you might be like, all right, well, that intervention sort of works. I became an effective altruist, even though that's on its way out now, which is not a bad thing in my mind, but that's just my own editorializing as we go along. Maybe you can point to some things like that. The reason you hear me hesitating is the question is not new. It's an ancient question. I have bookshelves filled with spiritualists from across religious traditions, wrestling constantly with how they're assessing their own progress in morality, whether they are aligning themselves with the divine or whether they are going to extract themselves from the cycle of suffering and so forth. And to the extent that we have been thinking ethically, we have been thinking about how does one assess oneself and if you're improving, and if you're actually doing better, it is an ancient question. And it's a good question. I'm a little bit worried of any one answer to how we would engage in good assessment.
Yeah, that makes sense. And your point is well taken that it's like you can't really use people as a control group relative to themselves. One thought I had at one point was like, given that ethics requirements were rolled out at different times, if you look at the cohort of medical students that graduated in 2006 and some of them were exposed to ethics education and some of them weren't, potentially you could look downstream and see like, in the long run, did the exposed group engage in more ethical behavior? Although obviously there's all sorts of problems with other things happening that led those schools to be particularly focused on those issues. So I actually wanted to follow up on the comment about effective altruism, because I suspect a fair number of our listeners will be effective altruists.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting to think about the relationship between effective altruism and ethics education, because I think one thing that effective altruists have done quite well is heighten people's moral perception. Like, a lot of people hear about the drowning child in the pond and are like, oh my God, like, there's so many wrongs in the world and I have to fix them. But I think a lot of people also are critical of effective altruists for being insufficiently morally humble, which is kind of interesting because there are some effective altruists who are taking moral humility really seriously. But the general vibe of EA is definitely not, wow, this is a really morally humble group. So I was kind of wondering if you have any thoughts on sort of how effective altruists are doing moral education and where you see them going awry.
Any program that invites us to think seriously and substantially about the impact of our actions is welcome. Effective altruists don't own that space, though, and sometimes they act as though they do.
Mm-hmm.
Just as though consequentialists sometimes talk as though they're the only ones that care about the consequences when it's not the case that they do. My concern with effective altruism is severalfold. The first is I'm not a consequentialist, and it is deeply, no, not exclusively, it is deeply informed by consequentialism. And I'm not a consequentialist because I think it misses vast aspects of the moral landscape, like just misses it, and often problematically so. And then the fact that when you will talk to effective altruists about this, they will often, attitudinally at least, consider you to be wishy-washy or squishy is a concern of mine. A second concern is that I feel that I always, and this is just my own disposition, I have a concern when something is so easily embraced by very hyper-capitalist, hyper-make-as-much-money-as-you-want groups. Not everyone is like that, but I keep feeling like there's probably something that's being missed then if everyone is getting on board with this for this reason. To me, I feel that, I hear your point, effective altruism makes people more morally perceptive about some things, but it can make them morally ignorant of others. If I'm just focused on, say, and this is a reduction a little bit of making a lot of money to give to this charity that I know is effective in doing this thing, I don't have to think about anything else. I've done my thing. That's the thing. That's measurable. It's quantifiable. It's here's the impact of it. So I don't think effective altruism is wrong in the sense that it's a good thing to think about impact, and it's a good thing to think about giving in an intentional way, and it's a good thing to think about these things. I just think that it suffers from some of the problems that I see most consequentialism suffering with, which we talked about before. The term is inappropriate, but it is blind to a lot of more reality.
Stepping back a bit, I think the last thing we'd like to ask you about is the philosophical underpinnings of your views on ethics pedagogy. So we know that you've been influenced recently by the ideas of Bernard Williams and Iris Murdoch. Could you tell us a bit more about how those ideas have influenced you with respect to the topics we've been discussing today?
Sure. And you've already heard me channel them a little bit. Part of it is a suspicion around moral theorizing. The way that I would put that suspicion is just, I don't think that that's the be-all, end-all. And to the extent that we focus on that, we might be missing something really important. And Bernard Williams was also very concerned with moral theorizing. Williams also regularly engages Greek mythology as a source of insight and inspiration for thinking ethically. Murdoch, I adore in part because of her emphasis on moral perception and just this notion of contact with moral reality and training yourself to take in it from different angles. I also love Murdoch because she's a fiction writer. And for her, she didn't have this bright line between her philosophizing and her fiction writing. They were intertwined. Some people think that means she was a bad philosopher, and other people mean she was a bad fiction writer, and I think she was actually good at both. Just in general, my philosophy behind ethics education is not we were doing it wrong, now we need to do it right. It's we were very limited in what we were doing. And the philosophers in the philosophy department are all brilliant and have exceptional things to say, but they just do ethics a certain way. And now someone comes in and says, we need to be doing that and all this more stuff. Well, who's going to be doing all that more stuff? Are you going to hire to do that more stuff? How do we even credentialize people to do this more stuff? What does it mean to bring in someone who's trained in surfacing moral perception? What does that even mean? But I'm less concerned with that in a sense because I don't want what's possible within a university to drive what we think actually goes into good moral education.
So we like to close by asking our guests, what is one norm broadly related to what we've been talking about that you would change if you could and why?
I'm sure it's, you'd guess my answer at this point. As someone who loves the arts, including pop culture, and has actually spent a good portion of my career trying to bring philosophy to wider audiences by engaging pop culture, I would like there to be more of a norm of bringing popular entertainment and the arts into the philosophy classroom more regularly by more people. I'd like for us to become a little bit more comfortable not being able to easily extract a clean argument, but nevertheless having something really important to say when we're doing ethics. I don't know if I'd be saying this if I was teaching a, you know, ontology class. I don't know if we need storytelling about whether there's a table or just a collection of table-like particles. But ethics is an orange, and we're trying to make a clockwork orange at times. And Anthony Bird just taught us how foolish that was. You can't make a clockwork orange. It's too squishy.
I feel like that's an appropriately literary point to end on. This has been really fun, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Bioethical is written and edited by me, Sophie Jabert, and Leah Pearson, with production by Audiolift.co. If you want to support the show, please subscribe, rate, and review it wherever you get your podcasts, and recommend it to a friend. You can also follow us on Twitter at Leah_Pearson and Sophie H. Jabert to be notified about new episodes. And you can sign up on our website, bioandethical.com, to receive emails when new episodes are released. We promise we won't spam you, but we may reach out to let you know about upcoming guests and give you the opportunity to submit questions. Our music is written by Nina Corey and performed by the band Social Skills. We're supported by a grant from Amplify Creative Grants. Links to papers we reference and other helpful resources are available on our website, bioandethical.com. You can submit feedback there or email us at bioandethical@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and for your support.